Today is Tuesday, November 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The latest on treatments for COVID-19.
And so what the producers of this antibody did is they found a way to make just a targeted antibody that binds the virus, the SARS-CoV-2 virus, binds the outside of the virus and prevents it from getting into our cells.
Plus, what's the significance of France's former president appearing in court Monday?
Mr. Sarkozy is the first ex-president in modern France to appear in the dock.
We'll have these stories and more next. The U.S. General Services Administration has ascertained that President-elect Biden is the winner of the November 3rd election. U.S. President Donald Trump, who has refused to concede the election, said on Monday that he is directing his team to cooperate on the transition, but is also vowing to keep up the fight. To that end, Georgia election officials are setting up for a recount that has been requested by the Trump administration. AP correspondent Jennifer King starts us off.
For the third time, the votes in the presidential race will be counted in Georgia. The Trump campaign sent a formal request for a recount to the Secretary of State's office on Saturday.
We're still working on the details of that. We want to talk to the counties first.
Georgia's voting system implementation manager, Gabriel Sterling, says the recount won't likely be finished until next week.
So it's not as quick and easy as throwing ballots on scanners and being done. For the small counties, they will get done relatively quickly. For the larger counties, it becomes a more of a logistical issue.
Under Georgia state law, a candidate can request a recount when the margin is less than 0.5%. I'm Jennifer King.
U.S. President-elect Joe Biden named his top diplomatic and national security team for the incoming administration on Monday, including one of his closest foreign affairs advisors, Anthony Blinken, to be Secretary of State. The AP's Ben Thomas has more on Blinken's background.
Blinken served as Deputy Secretary of State and Deputy National Security Advisor during the Obama administration and has close ties with Biden, recently participating in a national security briefing with the President-elect and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris. He's a graduate of Harvard University and Columbia Law School and a longtime Democratic foreign policy presence, serving on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration before becoming staff director for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee when Biden was chairman. Ben Thomas, Washington.
The incoming U.S. president-elect also picked African-American former ambassador Lisa Thomas Greenfield, a 35-year-old veteran of the U.S. Foreign Service who has served on four continents, to serve as the U.S. envoy to the United Nations. Biden elevated her role to a seat in his cabinet, a rank past presidents have also occasionally given to the high-profile position. Biden also picked another woman, Avril Haines, as Director of National Intelligence. She's a former deputy director of the Central Intelligence Agency and a deputy national security advisor, and if confirmed, she'll be the first woman to lead the U.S. intelligence community. Sources have told the Associated Press and the Wall Street Journal that President-elect Biden has also chosen former Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen to serve as the Treasury Secretary. Jake Sullivan, a Biden foreign affairs advisor, was also named as his national security advisor. AstraZeneca said on early Monday that clinical trials of its COVID-19 vaccine in Britain and Brazil have shown it is highly effective in preventing COVID-19 without hospitalizations or severe cases of the disease in any of the trial's volunteers. The England-based pharmaceutical company says the vaccine was 70% effective overall, but there were differences between two dosing regimens. One was 90% effective and the other just 62%. German pharmaceutical company CureVac says that it has signed a contract to produce major quantities of a COVID-19 vaccine under development in the Netherlands. And AP correspondent Charles Deledesma has that part of the story.
The company will produce its vaccine using mRNA technology at Wacker's site in Amsterdam in the first half of 2021. The plans for 100 million doses of the CureVac shot per year, with the potential for expansion. The company says the vaccine can be stored at regular refrigerated temperatures for up to 3 months, and even unrefrigerated at regular room temperatures for a period of 24 hours. CureVac isn't as far along in its trials as others, however, but says it plans to initiate a phase 2 clinical study before year's end. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Dr. Rajesh Gandhi is an infectious diseases physician at Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School. He's also a member of the NIH COVID-19 Treatment Guidelines Panel and the Infectious Diseases Society of America COVID-19 Treatment Guidelines Panel. Earlier today, I spoke to Dr. Gandhi about one possible treatment, bamlanivimab, and started by asking him what exactly it is and what does it do?
That's a good question. So bamlanivimab is an antibody. So what's an antibody? An antibody is a protein that the body makes to fight off infection. And so what the producers of this antibody did is they found a way to make just a targeted antibody that binds the virus, the SARS-CoV-2 virus, binds the outside of the virus and prevents it from getting into our cells. And the hope is that it'll work as an antiviral, as something that you know, disables and prevents the virus from reproducing itself or making new copies.
So this would be something that if you tested positive for COVID-19 and you are infected with the SARS-CoV-2, the novel coronavirus, this is something that would be administered for you if it's approved for use.
That's right. It's a treatment. So it's different than a vaccine. Vaccines are something that are used to build up the body's own immune system against the virus and to prevent someone from getting virus. This is after someone has been infected, they test positive. Right now it's authorized, not approved, but authorized by the US FDA to use in outpatients, people not sick enough to be in the hospital who have mild or moderate COVID-19. So they're not people that are having low oxygen or sick enough to be in the hospital, but they're people who have milder disease, some symptoms, and the hope is that this antibody will prevent them from getting sick enough to be in the hospital. So far, the studies that have been done of bamlanivimab are relatively small, a few hundred people, and so they're called phase 2 trials. They're not the definitive trials that prove a drug works, but the FDA thought that there was enough information that they authorized its use. My hope is that more and more trials will allow us to figure out if this drug really does work, and most importantly, who it works in. Right now, it's been authorized for high-risk people, but we don't yet know enough because the trials have been too small to answer who is it most beneficial for, and those are the kind of studies that still need to be completed.
Dr. Gandhi, remdesivir is another antiviral antibody medication. What's the difference between it and bamlanivimab?
Remdesivir is another type of antiviral, and that's been used to treat hospitalized patients. So unlike bamlanivimab, which is used to treat people who aren't yet in the hospital, milder disease, where remdesivir has been used in people who have been sick enough to be in the hospital. There is a bit of controversy right now because the WHO, the World Health Organization, just last week recommended against the use of remdesivir, whereas the U.S. guidelines have largely endorsed the use of remdesivir in hospitalized patients. I think the key difference here is remdesivir is not a home run. It doesn't reduce the likelihood of dying of COVID-19, and that's what the WHO was looking at. But what remdesivir does is it speeds up recovery. So even though we can't yet prove that it does the ultimate good, which is to prevent death, it does speed up recovery. And as our hospitals in the United States fill up, many of the U.S. guidelines panels, I'm a member of them, I feel like remdesivir does have a role in speeding up recovery. So that's kind of what's going on with remdesivir. As far as vaccines, vaccines are a really hot and important topic. These are to prevent COVID-19, so healthy people get it before they get sick. I think there'll be kind of an intersection. So vaccines will be used to prevent COVID-19, but they're not yet available. And in the meantime, those people who are getting COVID-19 do need treatments. Most COVID-19 is this mild to moderate that is not severe enough to be in the hospital. And that's where we're hoping that these antibodies, hopefully that'll prevent people from getting sick.
Dr. Rajesh Gandhi is an infectious diseases physician at Massachusetts General Hospital, Harvard Medical School, and a member of the NIH COVID-19 Treatment Guidelines Panel, as well as the Infectious Diseases Society of America's COVID-19 Treatment Guidelines Panel. The two most populous states in Australia reunited in an emotional scene on Monday as the border shut for only the second time in 101 years due to the coronavirus pandemic reopened. And the first flights since July took off for Sydney from Melbourne. Reuters' Flora Bradley Watson takes things from here.
Sirens ring out as the first cars cross the border from New South Wales into Victoria, Australia's two most populous states. They're the first to make the journey since July, when the border was closed due to the coronavirus pandemic. Victoria, once the epicenter of the country's outbreak, has now gone 24 days without recording a single new case. And that's prompted the border restrictions to be eased. The Premier of New South Wales, Gladys Berejiklian, said on Monday she hoped they would never need to be reintroduced.
Well, as I said yesterday, I never ever want us to be in a position ever again where we have to shut down our borders.
There's now expected to be a surge in air traffic between Melbourne and Sydney, one of the busiest routes in the world before the pandemic. Some 4,000 people were planning to fly between the two states on Monday, and donuts have been prepared at Sydney Airport to welcome them. People in Melbourne spoke of their relief to be able to travel again.
Oh, it's fantastic. Yeah, no, much waited for it, so it's good.
Now I can come visit my father when I need to, without having to worry about when I can get home.
Victoria also relaxed its rules on masks on Sunday, saying they were no longer required outside. And the state has allowed for larger public gatherings. Australia has recorded about 28,000 cases of COVID-19 and 907 deaths. 90% of those fatalities have been in Victoria.
That was Reuters reporter Flora Bradley-Watson. More than 58 million people around the world have been infected with the coronavirus. That's according to Johns Hopkins Resource Center in a Monday report. The U.S. continues to lead the world in infections with more than 12 million cases, followed by India with 9 million infections and Brazil with 6. The virus has claimed more than 1.3 million lives. More than 250,000 of those deaths were in the United States. Coming up later.
Wading through the water with their furry bodies, duck bills and webbed feet. The platypus is one of Australia's most unique mammals. But they're at risk.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists sifting through mountains of data gathered by NASA's Cassini mission continue to make amazing discoveries about Saturn and its moons. One of the highlights of the mission was the discovery of geysers spewing jets of icy water high above the ring planet's moon Enceladus. Researchers used that valuable Cassini data to create some new composite images that provide what the space agency says are the most detailed global infrared views ever produced of Enceladus. After analyzing the data they used to make the remarkable images, the researchers found what they call strong evidence that the moon's northern hemisphere has been resurfaced with ice from its interior. A theory put forth after Cassini snapped images of the jets of water erupting from the surface of Enceladus is that there is a massive liquid water ocean below its icy crust. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Former French President Nicolas Sarkozy was in court Monday. Reporter Catherine Field is in Paris and has been following the story closely. I spoke with her via WhatsApp to get the details.
The allegation is that while investigators were probing allegations that President Sarkozy had accepted illegal payments from L'Oreal Heiress for his presidential campaign, they stumbled on a conversation that former French President Nicolas Sarkozy had with his lawyer, in which he was asking for another lawyer to give him information illegally about a separate investigation. And these came from several wiretapped conversations. Now, of course, Mr. Sarkozy, his lawyer, and the magistrate that they're asking for information from deny these charges. And on top of that, former President Sarkozy and his lawyers say investigators had no right to wiretap those conversations. It was client-attorney privilege. And so no matter what they found, A, they shouldn't have been listening, and B, it doesn't stand up in court.
So the actual trial proceedings on Monday were fairly short. So what happens next?
Well, the trial had a difficult start because there are three defendants. Two of them were able to appear in court, French President Nicolas Sarkozy and his lawyer. The third accused is this magistrate. He is ill. He lives in the southwestern city of Bordeaux. He's also aged in his 70s, and his doctors say he can't possibly travel. Not only is he ill, but also because of the COVID crisis, he is actually in that age group for people that the government is saying, stay home, don't move. So he couldn't go to the trial. So really, virtually straight away, the judge said, okay, I'm going to have to go away, going to have to deliberate about this. So after 30 minutes, he went away. He came back and said, all right, I'm going to send doctors down to Bordeaux to investigate this, and I want a medical assessment. So after just 2 hours, this court case that everyone has been just literally waiting to happen was adjourned, and we'll all come back on Thursday to hear what the medical assessment of this co-defendant is.
Catherine, now this is not the first controversy to follow former President Sarkozy around. Can you kind of walk us through some of the other controversies in the former president's life?
Well, one of the main allegations has been to do with campaign funding. He apparently, during his failed 2012 election bid, received money from offshore accounts. There are also various allegations that his earlier campaign in 2007 received funding from Libya's former leader, Muammar Gaddafi. These are all allegations that keep swirling around him. But the bottom line on this one was, Mr. Sarkozy is the first ex-president in modern France.
The eight-year Islamist insurgency in the West African nation of Mali shows no sign of ending, even after an August coup that toppled President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita. The country's transitional government has indicated that it is willing to open dialogue with all armed groups. France, which has more than 5,000 troops in the country, has warned against any discussions with militants. Nicolas Pinault has more.
With terrorists, we do not discuss, we fight. The statement made recently by French President Emmanuel Macron in an interview is, to some analysts, a clear rebuke of the strategy initiated by transitional Malian authorities who are willing to open discussions with jihadists. Nicolas Normand is a former ambassador of France to Mali.
This is at odds with a desire of the Malian opinion to undertake a dialogue with Iyadak Gali, Amadou Koufa. There is nothing to negotiate, actually, because the jihadist leaders do not ask for pardon or for reintegration in the Malian society. They want to impose a totalitarian regime. And, of course, Bamako resists against such a will. But I think the population is not really aware of what is at stake in their own liberty.
Following the signature of the so-called Algiers peace agreement, armed groups were supposed to join the national army. 5 years after the agreement, little progress has been made toward its implementation. According to Thierry Virculon, a researcher with the French Institute of International Relations,
if the dialogue that the new authorities in Bamako wants to start is about the implementation of the Algiers Agreement, this is actually a very good development. So far, the Algiers Agreement, its implementation has been blocked by the previous Malian president, who was really opposed to that agreement and didn't make any progress. The only way to make a progress in the Malian conflict is actually to implement this agreement.
Macron's comments about the dialogue contrast with the pro-French sentiment in Mali in early 2013, when French forces stopped jihadists from going to seize Bamako, the capital. Nicolas Normand says Macron's remarks show a growing gap between the Malian population and the former colonial power.
In 2013, when the French army intervened in Mali to combat the armed groups, they supported the separatists and they fought only against the jihadists. After 8 years, there is no real improvement in the security situation, despite many jihadists killed. 8 years is too long for the army of the former colonial power to stay in the country. The population does not understand.
Macron also said he will make decisions in the coming months on how to develop the French force, known as Barkhane, in the Sahel. With more than 50 French troops killed and little progress to report since the deployment, observers say France is considering pulling back its forces and encouraging other European nations to commit more forces to the region. Nicolas Pinault for VOA News, Paris.
It appears that the talks mediated by the United States between Israel and Lebanon may have stalled after both sides traded verbal jabs over the weekend. From Beirut, Lebanon, reporter George Eade gave me the latest via WhatsApp.
Well, in an unprecedented move, Israel has called upon the Lebanese president Michel Aoun to start direct calls between the two countries on the disputed maritime borders. The message came from the Israeli energy minister Yuval Steinmetz, who proposed to Lebanese president Michel Aoun that the talks should take place in Europe. The gesture is a rare one between the two countries that are still technically at war. Israel and Lebanon had opened indirect negotiations on the borders issue under U.S. and U.N. auspices last month. However, it was only last week that Steinmetz himself accused Lebanon on Twitter of undermining the talks by continuously shifting its position and trying to widen the disputed area under negotiations. On the other hand, President Aoun rejected Steinmetz's accusations through Twitter. However, in a series of tweets directed at the Lebanese president on Monday, Steinmetz wrote both in Hebrew and in Arabic, "I have been enjoying the dialogue that has developed between us in recent days," and he was pointing out at the dispute on Twitter between him and the President Michel Aoun. And he added, "I'm confident that if we could meet face-to-face in a European country in order to have an open or secret negotiation, we would have a good chance of resolving the maritime border dispute once and for all." On the Lebanese side, the response came from the media advisor of the Lebanese president, whose name is Rafik Shlela. He confirmed to media outlets in Lebanon that President Michel Aoun insists on his previous approach and response to the Israelis' accusations, and deemed the issue non-negotiable and unthinkable. Aoun confirmed that the fifth round of indirect talks between the two nations will be held at the on the 2nd of December 2020.
So, George, if the two sides can't reach an agreement on this maritime border, whether it be on those scheduled December 2nd talks or in some other kind of European scheduled talks, what happens?
Well, analysts in Lebanon fear that this might lead in the future to conflicts. You know that in Lebanon, there is a militia group named Hezbollah, and it is backed up by Iran. So we do not know if at this stage it might go into a hostile position and thus have a conflict over these territories, because Israel is determined to explore for gas in these regions. And Lebanon is also, on the other part, very stiff on that regard, and it is backing up its position totally. So one thing that analysts fear is a long-term effect, which might lead to further hostilities on the borders between the two countries. And we do remind that the last war between the two countries was in 2006.
George Eade reports from Beirut. Israeli media reports that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu traveled to Saudi Arabia Sunday and held a secret meeting with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. The Saudi foreign minister denied the reports, and Netanyahu refused to comment. Israel sees Saudi Arabia as the key to a moderate axis in the Middle East that can challenge Iran. The resiliency of journalists who brave arrests, attacks, and repressive legislation was celebrated at the annual International Press Freedom Awards last week. Hosted by the Committee to Protect Journalists, the 2020 awardees are from Bangladesh, Iran, Nigeria, and Russia. VOA's press freedom editor, Jessica Jarit, has that story.
Protests, violence, and coronavirus-related restrictions. Journalists have never been so tested as this year, says Courtney Raj of the Committee to Protect Journalists.
On top of the kind of perennial threats that you have to journalists and media outlets around the world, from censorship to imprisonment to murder, you now have a global pandemic which has fundamentally reconfigured economic, social, political systems, and you've never needed journalism more.
This year, the committee honored journalists in Bangladesh, Iran, Nigeria, and Russia, who have shown the importance of independent media amid great opposition. Journalists like Dabo Olorioami, co-founder of Nigeria's Premium Times. Arrested twice for his reporting, Olorioami says the media are working in more restrictive environments.
We have about 28 constraining laws in our statute. I just make a work of journalism with very difficult and nervous experience in the country. Increasingly, too, I think it's the whole developments around cybercrime in the country. We have some of these really crazy laws that then criminalize the work of journalism.
Laws around the use of electronic media and false news are also a problem in Bangladesh. Photojournalist Shahid Alam says press freedom there has gone downhill.
We were under military rule at one point. That's when I had a loaded gun pointed at my head. When democracy came, we thought things would change. But this is by far the worst it's ever been. I think we live in an environment of fear.
In Iran, where access to independent journalism is limited, freelancer Mohammed Masood covered corruption, economic sanctions and protests on his now suspended social media accounts. Sharif Mansour, Middle East Programme Coordinator, CPJ.
We and a lot of journalists around the world have relied on people like Mohammed in times of crisis. He's providing a service to Iranian citizens and to the international community at the same time. And for him to be jailed just for stating facts under those dubious charges is just shows how the Iranian government disregard of media and of journalism in principle.
Because of her work, Russian journalist Svetlana Prokofieva was convicted by a court in July of justifying terrorism. Despite the risks, she remains committed to journalism.
What we do is normal and should exist in a normal society. But if we abandon our profession, stop what we do, then our country, our society as a whole, will be even further from normality, from civilization, than it is now.
With journalism under threat, the work of international lawyers like Armel Clooney is ever more important to defend press freedom, says Raj.
The recognition of Armel Clooney with the Gwen Ifill Press Freedom Award this year really recognizes the symbiosis between the legal community and the journalistic community. We need each other.
With press freedom under attack, that support has never been more important. Jessica Jarit, VOA News.
Australian scientists pushed on Monday to list the platypus as a vulnerable species after a report showed that the habitat of the semi-aquatic native mammal had shrunk more than a fifth in the last 30 years. Reuters' Ema McCarthy reports.
Wading through the water with their furry bodies, duck bills and webbed feet, the platypus is one of Australia's most unique mammals. But they're at risk, with Australian scientists calling on Monday to list the platypus as a vulnerable species after a report showed that their habitat had shrunk more than a fifth in the last 30 years. Severe drought brought about by climate change, land clearing for farming and dam building are to blame, according to researchers at the University of New South Wales, who made recommendations to government scientific panels. Professor Richard Kingsford is the director of the university's Centre for Ecosystem Science.
It can't live outside water, and so with increasing drying of the Australian continent and our propensity to take more water out of the rivers means that some of those pools that were permanent are probably going to dry up more in the future as, you know, we get increased temperatures and evaporation. But as well as that, they're affected by pollution, they're affected by invasive species, they're affected by a range of other threats which are major challenges to platypus.
Research models show that platypus numbers may have more than halved over several decades, but figures are hard to pinpoint.
Platypus are a bit out of sight, out of mind. You know, no one really sees them that often because they're nocturnal. We don't know that much about them because they're difficult to work on. And so if you like the sort of iconic species like koala become the poster child for conservation. But, you know, I think platypus are really, we're missing the major changes that are occurring for this species. And unless we get this right, we're really going to be in trouble.
More resources can be deployed to protect their habitats once they are on the threatened list.
That was Reuters reporter Emer McCarthy. And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a terrific Tuesday.